episode 20 of Not Another Teen Wolf podcast. This is our, I guess, milestone 20th episode and one of our last bite-sized before season 3 comes back. This week, our bite-sized is all about the mythology of werewolves in our various fandoms, and it's me and Karen, as per usual, and we are joined by my friend Jonathan Kearns, who is a bit of a semi-expert on the topic of strange mythologies due to various aspects of his life. As usual, you can reach us on our Twitter, which is NATW Podcast, our Tumblr, which is notanotherteenwolfpodcast.tumblr, or our email, which is natwpodcast@gmail.com. So, how are you today, Karen?
I'm very good.
Good. And how are you today, Jonathan?
I am very good as well.
Okay, cool. Jonathan, do you want to just introduce yourself and say sort of what you do and how it ties into why you're here right now?
I can try. I'm a rare book dealer. I work in an antiquarian bookshop in London. And how it ties into this, I don't know really. I mean, there's lots of books involved.
Profound.
I sell a lot of the books from which the original mythology was kind of sourced, collected, you know, collated. It's just one of the areas that we deal in, sort of esoterica, the occult, this kind of stuff. So obviously you get involved in the modern version and then you get involved in the old version and then you see how they mesh in the middle. I think that's probably one of the reasons I'm here, is to do some meshing.
Yeah, I made him watch the show a while ago because he likes things such as this, geeky shows that are good, as well as externally, you know, appearing to the world like a bit of a literary snob or whatever, given the industry. Not a snob, but to the outside world. And so it's a good, you are also a good meshing of those things. So, Karen, do you want to sort of explain what we're going to do in this episode?
Yeah, this is going to be a pretty fun one, actually. We're going to talk about all the different types of mythology that has to do with werewolves. First, we're going to sort of take the traditional legends and sort of, you know, establish that there. And then we're going to take a bunch of different shows or books or movies that have werewolves in them and kind of compare it and then figure out which one is the most realistic. So I guess we should probably start off with the more popular legends of werewolf mythology.
So, yeah, Jonathan, what is, from your information, where did the werewolf legends come from and, like, what were the first ones around?
The first one that immediately springs to mind is probably from the first century AD, and that's a pretty long time ago, really. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of 14th and 15th century references, usually from people with names like Berthold of Regensburg and things like that, where they're talking about disappearing children and things like that. But there's a novel called Satyricon by a man called Petronius in the first century AD, which has a whole section talking about somebody who witnesses a man turning into a wolf. It's all pretty weird and esoteric. He sees this man who then strips off all his clothes, throws them on the ground, urinates around them in a circle, and then turns into a wolf and runs off. And forever after, he's unable to sit down and eat normal food with normal people at tables and things like that. It's a whole thing. I mean, the whole novel is weird and mad and crazy and peculiar. But it's one of the earliest kind of references to somebody transforming into a wolf in front of witnesses. There's a Greek myth. It's also kind of cool, about a man whose name is actually Lycan or Lycaon, depending on how you say it. Zeus cursed with turning into a wolf because he attempted to test Zeus's godliness by feeding him human flesh, which ties in with the whole concept that is probably most marked in J.K. Rowling, where being a werewolf is like a punishment. It's a curse that's inflicted upon you, and it's something you suffer rather than something that makes you kind of cool. the traditional concept of werewolfism or lycanthropy, whatever you want to call it, is that it's a curse and a punishment, and you've done something horrible, or you've made a deal with the devil, or you've... Often cannibalism is a thing that you've done that's resulted in this being inflicted on you. Because the werewolf myth is pretty much connected to the Wendigo myth and things like that in Native American cultures. Someone who has eaten human flesh.
So you're saying basically that it's, in mythology in general, a curse or a punishment because a human has done something wrong.
Usually, yes. Yes. You've usually tried to do something evil and bad, or you've tried to make a deal with somebody you shouldn't, and as a result of that, you end up being cursed with the ability to turn into a wolf.
Okay. And then when did the ideas about, like, the full moon and all of those kind of traditional ideas that we sort of know now as sort of the, you know, the big bad monster myth come in?
Well, that's kind of... A lot of the myths are 19th century onwards. The full moon one, I think, probably ties in with the whole... For centuries, werewolfism, or being a werewolf and being a witch, went hand in hand. Nowadays, you might kind of think of it as being a vampire. You'd have the vampire-werewolf kind of like duo happening. In the 14th and 15th centuries, it was witches. The whole witchcraft phenomenon was intimately connected with the idea of werewolves. Witches were supposed to be able to tame wolves, be like wolf whisperers, I suppose, or hire werewolves and get them to serve them and this kind of stuff. It was all tied in together, which I think has a lot to do with the reason that the whole witch craze took off in the first place. Has to do with the fact that there's a fear of the unknown, and there's also a lot of greed and social pressures involved. Witches were primarily women at that particular point, so you need a kind of male counterpart in some ways. So the whole, you know, she's a witch and he can turn into a wolf, I saw him, is kind of they kind of go hand in hand together. The full moon idea is basically rooted in witchcraft. Covens and sabbats were supposed to take place on the nights of the full moon. The devil was supposed to walk the earth on the nights of the full moon, that kind of stuff. So I imagine it kind of links that. Plus, wolves hunt during the full moon. So you're more likely to hear wolves howling and see wolves about during a full moon period because, well, visibility is better, basically. There's always this thread of practicality running through the whole thing. So it sounds like a myth. It sounds like a kind of fantasy. But at the same time, there's always going to be a grain of truth somewhere in the background.
Karen, do you want to sort of talk about the canon of what we have for teen wolves, werewolves, and we'll see if any of that comes up in any folklore or anything?
Teen wolf is pretty straightforward. There's two types of werewolves. You have the hereditary, like Derek, and then you have the bitten, like Scott. Werewolfism cannot be transferred via scratch. That's sort of been proven. And then this is interesting in that they can transform at will, or it's from an emotional trigger. Plus, the full moon does have a sort of impact on them. Control can be maintained so that they won't shift during the full moon, but that kind of comes with more experience as being a werewolf. And then you have all the senses are enhanced. This is also in the human form. You have healing, more rapid healing if you get hurt. Wolfsbane can kill them. And, of course, you know, the Argents and the Hunters, they sort of use Wolfsbane in the bullets, and that can kill a werewolf. And the Silver Legend in Teen Wolf comes from the Argent family name. And Mountain Ash and other things like that also crop up here and there. To kill a wolf, you could cut them in half. They can't actually heal from that. And you can burn them alive in a fire. Of course, we know about that one pretty well. And this is the interesting thing, too, is that some can take the form of a full wolf and others sort of... Natalie's written here, ours just have sideburns and smooshy faces, which I think is quite appropriate. So yeah, we don't really know why there's a difference yet, but hopefully in season 3 we will. And then the transformation is not particularly painful, and, you know, they have the claws come out. I'm sure that doesn't feel very well, but it's not too bad. And then, you know, we have packs and alphas and all of that sort of thing. So I would think, like, as far as maybe not the traditional stories in folklore, but what we as sort of a modern society know about werewolves, this is still a fairly typical kind of representation of werewolves.
Yeah, like what aspects of Teen Wolf sort of are the kind of aspects that have shown up in both, I guess, not the very first stories, but yeah, the way that the idea of werewolves have developed and what is very individual to the show. Like, I've never heard of another wolf legend that has both the hereditary and bitten aspect. That's one thing that I've never seen before. But what did you think when you watched it, Jonathan?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That the hereditary and bitten aspect is two different groups, right? Primarily, werewolves that we have on in pop culture these days are what we call Germanic werewolves, which they all... I mean, the word werewolf is an old English word where were means adult male and wolf means wolf. So it's basically adult male human turning into wolf, which means, of course, they're primarily men. And it's primarily something that occurs in this, well, my part of Europe, as it were. They're a legend that comes from deep forests. They're from places like Bavaria, Austria, you know, they're kind of the middle of Germany, the Schwarzwald, this kind of stuff. All the places that your original fairy tales come from, Hansel and Gretel and this kind of stuff. There's always these deep woods, there's always these hidden places, and there's always something out there that you have to be scared of. However, the hereditary side of it is usually more sort of eastern, like sort of Romania and Serbia and places like that. Children that were born with cauls on their heads or with birthmarks or whatever were supposed to genetically have the ability to turn into wolves. Whereas the bitten aspect is a thing that happens, again, as a kind of punishment for straying off the path, which is what all the big deep woods fairy tales type of stuff is about. It's generally your parents will tell you something horrible will happen to you if you go into the woods on your own. We've all experienced this in fairy tales and read it in various, you know. Neil Gaiman's very good at expressing this in various things. It's a punishment. So you get bitten, then you change. The hereditary thing is more of an Eastern werewolf idea, where it's a kind of genetic mutation, an anomaly that occurs from birth. So the hybrid version, the mix that Teen Wolf has, is actually quite interesting. The transforming at will, that's part and parcel of the same sort of thing. That's a sort of hybrid. I mean, it was that you had no choice about it, and whenever the full moon came up, you would turn into a werewolf, and it would hurt, and you would suffer, etc., etc., etc. And then on the other aspect, there's some of the more ancient stories say that you can just do it whenever you feel like it by putting on a wolfskin belt or taking all your clothes off and saying a word or something. So it's a mishmash of various different influences and various different ideas. The enhanced senses stuff, yep, absolutely. You're turning into an animal, so there's always this feeling that there's got to be some beneficial trade-off happening from that. Increased sense of smell, strength, everything else. The wolfbane bit is interesting, because that used to be a cure for being a werewolf.
See, because we've talked about that, you know, about wolfsbane maybe being like kryptonite, in that there's all different types, and that some might be damaging and some might help them in some way. So we're wondering if that might end up coming up in this show.
Probably. I mean, the mountain ash thing, that's, again, a lot of these aspects are borrowed from other mythologies, not just by Teen Wolf, but just in general. Silver, for example, is an invention, a total invention, that only showed up in the 1930s. Before that, there's no actual kind of like proper serious references to silver being any use against werewolves at all. Sorry, that just sounds a bit weird. But
well, where did that come from then?
It actually comes from the most impressive thing. While I was watching the first season of Teen Wolf, because I'm a colossal nerd and everything to do with books some way interests me, there's that scene where they introduce her to the legend of the Beast of Gévaudan, which is a real thing. Well, I say real. In 1764 and 1767 or 68, there was a beast or some beasts in the French province of Gévaudan who killed about somewhere between 80 and 115 men, women and children. They went on a massive rampage, whatever they were. People said they were giant wolves. People said they were hyenas. People said they were something strange and peculiar and unkillable. And they went on this massive rural rampage and slaughtered people right, left and centre. And the whole of France was galvanised by this and everyone was terrified. The king sent his two most famous huntsmen down there to sort the problem out. There was widespread panic. Of course, it's a very religious period, so everybody's convinced that somebody's dealing with the devil or indulging in witchcraft or something like that. As always, these things tie in together. And there was a man called, I've got to remember this, his name was Jean Chastet, I think, or Chasselet. And he was a local huntsman, and he claimed that he had killed the beast. And it was rumoured later that he had killed the beast using a blessed silver bullet of his own creation. This first appeared, the first time that actually appeared was in 1935 in a French story talking about the Beast of Gévaudan. I think it's a kind of, it's necessary. When you start to fictionalise things, when you have a, like a TV series or whatever, if you have a beast, a big bad, like Joss Whedon would say, so therefore you have to invent a way to kill it, and then that becomes canon, as it were. So,
The Beast of Jevernum was like a legend, and then when someone actually tried to make it into a proper book, they had to have a solid reason why it was killed.
Well, you've always got to kind of shine it up a bit, I
think. Yeah.
Chastel, that was his name. He basically was a local huntsman, and there was this real controversy that hit the beast was actually his.
Him. Oh, his.
Something to do with him. Or possibly him. I mean, there was the werewolf idea. Werewolves are the first people to be kind of accused of this awfulness. And one of the side effects, kind of one of the less pleasant side effects, is that nearly every wolf or creature over the size of a squirrel in that area was wiped out during the whole process, because they killed everything that moved on the basis that it could easily be the Beast of Jevernum. They also persecuted, attacked, and on occasion killed strangers who had come into the region on the grounds that they might be the Beast of Jevernum. And it's this standard thing where it's like, kind of, we don't know what's out there, so therefore we're going to either kill everything that moves or hide and then blame everything that we don't really understand. So the idea is that one of the possibilities is that Chastel had been breeding wolf-dog hybrids, which was, you know, a thing that people did in those days. And he'd somehow created a bunch of big wolf-dog hybrids that were pretty violent, unpleasant, and went and killed some people. The other idea was that he'd come back from somewhere foreign with something massive and dangerous. There was a hyena corpse that was discovered in some Parisian museum that was supposed to have been sent from Jevodan at some point.
Yeah.
And they did, in fact, like I say, they virtually wiped out all the wolves in the area. In werewolf pop culture, it's always important to remember that up until the late 19th century, being attacked by a wolf was actually a thing that could happen in mainland Europe. You know, the last one in Britain probably was killed in the 18th century, but or maybe a little bit earlier. But in mainland Europe, you could be attacked by wolves.
I think the Teen Wolf's quite interesting in that it actually played in that legend of the Beast of Jevernum then, because that's, you don't really see that kind of thing in, I don't know about some of the other ones, but you don't really see them playing into the existing mythologies that are in the world in a lot of werewolf pop culture. You sort of see them making up their own, and they don't reference ones that exist in our real world. So that's...
Well, the picture that they use, the, you know, the thing on...
On the necklace.
Image of the Beast of Jevernum is actually from the 18th century engraving of the beast. Circulated widely as being, look out for this creature, it might eat your legs or something. It's, you know, so they've actually made a pretty strong attempt at getting some historical verisimilitude in there, which is one of the things that first impressed me. So I'm sitting there watching it, and then I go, oh my god, that is the Beast of Jevernum, and then everyone else in the room tells me to shut up because I'm a giant nerd. But
that's
good. So,
yeah. It's I mean, it's really interesting to know that Teen Wolf is that. Has that much attention to detail, and that they're going that much into mythology rather than just being like, oh yeah, this is our show about made-up stuff, we can just make up whatever we want.
Yeah, well, they're going the right way of using sort of decent source material. Basically, I think there's only like 3 references in pop culture to the Beast of Jevernum. It's not something you come across very often. it's a bit of a thing that if you said it out loud, most people would be like, what are you talking about?
But
it's there. I was impressed.
Yeah, the next one, I mean, you mentioned Rowling, the next one on our list of pop culture werewolves was the Harry Potter world, and in that world, it's passed on by a bite, not a scratch. We've got proof that it can't be passed on by a scratch. It's the really traditional idea that we think of with a werewolf, which is like an uncontrollable transformation once a month on the night of the full moon into a full wolf that's nearly indistinguishable from a wild wolf. The werewolf is sort of vicious and mindless. The transformation is painful and it's like hard to heal from. It's helped by the wolfsbane potion, so we don't know if that's made out of the plant wolfsbane, but it helps the wolf and it helps the person. It lets him keep his human mind so that he doesn't be destructive and all of that kind of thing. They're known about by the rest of their society, like wizarding society, but they're somewhat oppressed and regulated. There's like anti-werewolf registrations, and J.K. Rowling has said that Lupin, like Professor Lupin being a werewolf, is a metaphor for people's reactions to illness and disability. She's actually also compared it to like the way that people treat people with AIDS. Most of the werewolves in Harry Potter live outside society and hate society. There's very few that are like Lupin who actually just try and live within normal society. Most of them are sort of a bit like black market and dodgy, and they don't have a standard pack formation. So I don't know when the pack legend with the pack aspect.
Mainly invented fairly recently.
Actually, yeah, came in.
The male thing, because I think the concept of alphas in nature dates from like the 60s. I think somebody did a study of wolves and discovered that, you know, that was a...
Oh, so that wasn't a thing that was really known about before science.
Werewolves are generally, in folklore, solitary.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know... Because the whole thing about werewolves, in contrast to vampires, for example, is that you know where vampires live, right? They live in a castle on the hill. Buffy did that, where it's sort of, you know, when Dracula came to Sunnydale, they were like, I didn't know there was a castle here.
Yeah.
Whereas werewolves live next door to you. Fear of vampires is a kind of folkloric fear of people who are your superiors, who might turn out to be evil and dangerous. Fear of werewolves is fear of your neighbours. It's being afraid of the people next to you not being who they are. So it's kind of like the everyman, the ordinary person's version of a vampire, as it were. Living outside society and being kind of the lone wolf, as it were, no pun intended. And they're generally solitary. The whole pack idea would make them a lot more kind of mainstream, I think. It's a relatively recent thing. But J.K. Rowling's idea of it being a metaphor for people's reactions to illness and disability is kind of weird, because a lot of people have tried to interpret the whole werewolf myth as being people's reactions to a medical condition, for example. Hypertrichosis, where you grow lots of hair all over the place, or Down syndrome, where you look other, you look different from everyone else. I mean, basically, the Putian idea is the persecution of someone who doesn't look like you and your best friends. It's a standard thing, which is probably why it translates so well into sort of like teenage high school culture.
Yeah. So the next one is Buffy, which doesn't have too much... I mean, we have werewolves in Buffy. There's only a couple of episodes that focus on it, but we do know a bit about it. So, Karen, did you want to talk about the Buffy stuff?
The werewolves in Buffy are turned via a bite, and this is sort of interesting in that they do this during the 3 days around the full moon. So it's not just the night of the full moon. And, you know, otherwise it's pretty typical. They're super strong in wolf form. They prey on humans. They attack and kill people. They don't actually remember most of their time as a wolf. So it's very animalistic, I suppose. And they do have some animal characteristics at all times, like the sense of smell and ability to sense other werewolves, that sort of thing. So that sort of plays into Teen Wolf as well. They can be killed by silver weapons. They have hunters that hunt them. And I guess it's sort of like a big game sort of thing. If you can catch a werewolf, then that's a big deal. And we're not really going to go into depth with this with Supernatural, but it's sort of the same concept too with Supernatural.
Rather than like protecting the world, it's like, oh, I'm cool, I shot a werewolf,
yeah,
kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. The look of it is that when Oz transforms, he kind of looks like Scott. He's like half transformed, and later we see him, he's all like hairy and stuff like that. And they can learn techniques to control the transforming. Oz does a sort of meditation, and because emotional stress can trigger it. And they are sort of solitary creatures as well. They don't have a pack. They're not, you know, usually found in groups.
I mean, yeah, there was only a couple of episodes in Buffy about the werewolves, but and one or two in Angel as well. And there appear to be a few different breeds of werewolves, but the main thing I noticed in Buffy with the werewolves was, like, Oz, when he meets the other werewolf, Veruca, it's sort of comparable to Lupin and Fenrir Greyback, or even Scott and Derek, which is that you have sort of the one werewolf who wants to live within society versus the other one who's like, oh no, we're free, or we're above this, or we're below this, or whatever, the ones that... that you've got your central character, werewolf, who's like trying to fit in and just be a part of society and deal with this thing that's happening to him, versus other aspects who, and I'm sure we'll see this even more with the Alpha Pack than with Derek, other werewolves who are happy to live outside society and think that they're above humans or think that they're, you know, a very much other, whereas Oz or Scott or Lupin are trying to just be people despite the fact that they're werewolves. So that's interesting that we always focus around sort of our main character as a werewolf like that.
I think that's at the core of the entire werewolf idea, is do I go the feral direction or do I go the retaining my humanity direction? And I think it's most clarified in Teen Wolf, but also probably done most sensitively by Oz in Buffy. It's that whole resisting the whole process to the point where it doesn't just become this biological imperative, it's something psychological as well. So he controls his emotions and his fears and anger, etc.
Yeah.
Aspect of himself, which is kind of typically Oz really during that period of Buffy. But Joss Whedon doesn't usually miss a trick. So the whole werewolf thing in Joss Whedon is a slightly more complex view of like young culture, etc. And also the whole idea of you don't have to be a slave to your emotions or the way that you feel about things. And it's a recurring theme throughout the whole Oz werewolf cycle.
True story. I was once at a convention with Seth that Seth Green was at, and someone was in the audience who basically gave him this really long sob story about how I don't know what was wrong with her, but she was like, I'm your biggest fan. I watched the Buffy DVDs after school every day. I don't know. She seemed normal, but she was just saying this, like, she was talking really strangely. But she was sort of leading up to this thing, and then she was just like, her question was, in deadpan seriousness, are you really a werewolf? And he was like, yeah, I am. I met Joss Whedon at this underground revelry club for werewolves, and I really appreciate him, like, giving me a job. Because I thought I would never get to work as an actor because I was a werewolf. And I got to find this job where I really got to, like, use the skills that I had. And, like, deadpan, and I'm like, I don't know what just happened. It was odd and amazing, but it was very strange.
It's like Byron and vampires.
Oh, God.
Well, he did this when The Vampire came out in the 19th century. Everyone started talking to Byron about vampires.
Like they were real.
Yeah, he wrote this letter saying, I never associate with vampires. They're not the kind of people I want to hang out with.
Yeah.
And then everyone kind of went, oh, my God. Same sort of thing. Nothing ever changes. Fandom is fandom.
I can't believe you're comparing Byron to Seth Green. I hate Seth you.
Seth Green and Byron would probably get on really well.
Say words like that. Go home. Like, no. I don't like Byron. Sorry. Just for the record, everyone.
Nobody liked Byron, but Byron liked himself less than everyone else. So.
Oh, don't try and make me feel sorry for him.
He gets a pass for being all kind of genius and tortured. It's, you
know. Whatever. All right.
Okay, well, sorry.
The next one is Twilight, so you get to have fun with that.
Oh, God.
Twilight is interesting because they're not technically werewolves. And what's interesting, I'm just going to talk about this very quickly, because in their world, there are traditional werewolves. It's actually mentioned at a point that they have, like, that there are real werewolves and that don't have packs, that are more of our traditional style werewolf, and that people are mixing up, like, the Jacob Black, etc., with traditional werewolves. The werewolves that we see in Twilight are technically a spirit warrior shapeshifter. It's a hereditary thing, not anything to do with a bite or anything like that. It's something that comes out when, basically, they were made as a predator to the vampires in Twilight, and the change comes on when the generation sense that there are vampires around. They're like sleeper agents, because I think there was the generation above Jacob was not werewolves, but their grandfathers were or whatever. They shift into, like, giant, full wolves, like horse-sized wolves. They keep their own mind. They can also shift when they're triggered by anger or stress. But basically, they just, like, become, like, perfect physical specimens, like, strong and super speedy and reflexes in human form. They run at, like, a higher body temperature, which is random. They have accelerated healing, like a teen wolf, except their healing is not perfect. Like, bones can set wrong and have to be rebroken. They just grow back together really quickly. They have a really strong pack thing, like they're psychic with their other pack members. They have, like, alpha, and their betas are their second-in-command, not just everyone. They've got alpha, beta, and then the rest. And apparently the real werewolves, the moon werewolves. The moon does not affect our Jacob Black and etc. But the real werewolves don't have a pack, but these shapeshifters do. The other big aspect is that they don't age while shifting. So if they're continuously shifting, they're just going to be these teenagers forever, almost in a stasis thing, to the point where the one girl who's a werewolf, Leah, doesn't get her period. Like, she doesn't think she's ever going to have a baby if she keeps shifting as a werewolf, because it seems to just freeze their body into that thing, which is weird. And of course, the other big aspect on it, which we haven't touched on in any of our ones yet, is imprinting, which is like a soulmate, like, you know, the wolf has a mate, and they imprint on humans, not on other werewolves, but it's a very much a sort of, you are my soulmate, I am obsessed with you, and I'm going to, you know, follow you until you love me, papa, paparazzi kind of thing. So, so that's Twilight's werewolves, like, in inverted commas, because they keep stressing that they're not actual werewolves, but... I mean, is there any aspect of the Twilight werewolves that impresses you, or, like, anything that ties... I mean, they have a really long backstory about, like, the ancient Native American legends, which may be or may not be accurate. I don't know.
I think you're probably best off going with may not, with anything to do with Twilight, where you can go, oh, that's entertaining and fairly pleasant. Then you look at it more deeply and you go, that's really gross and creepy. How did that happen?
Yeah. I mean, this one, again, was all very male-dominated, like that one girl is the only girl who's ever been one, and I think they even say, oh, maybe it's because she's, like, not very girly and had a lot of testosterone that she got to be a werewolf too, and it's like, oh, okay.
Thank you for that. That was a really good contribution to pop culture, along with the glittery bit on vampires. That was nice too. Thank you. But it's just, I understood that, I mean, the whole idea of them turning into whatever they turn into as a reaction to threat... because the Cullens have moved back into the area, they become werewolves.
Yeah.
Wolves. And wasn't the wolf the totem of their tribe? Which is
I mean, that was...
Isn't it lucky the totem wasn't a fish?
I think that was the whole thing. I mean, I read it, and I didn't want to put all these in the notes, but there was this massive legend about how the werewolves, like, how these guys came to be, that they used to just be, like, spirit warriors who could go, like, join with animals, but then someone... was shifted into his animal form and they killed the body, like they killed his real body or something, and then it all went downhill or uphill or whatever you want to call it from there.
Yeah,
so.
the third wife.
How do you know these things?
These things stick in my head because I read too much stuff and it stays in my head with some...
Do you want to tell us why you've read Twilight?
I thought the first one was kind of cute. It was nice. I like... the whole love story aspect. And I don't, to be honest, I'll be completely honest and say that her response to Stephanie Meyer's response to coming up with the prop to dealing with the problems of writing about vampires or writing about werewolves or whatever, none of those responses are ridiculous. If you look at the first appearance of Silver killing a werewolf is 1935.
Yeah.
I think possibly 1941. There's a movie made where the werewolf got stabbed with a silver tipped cane or something. 1819, beginning of the 19th century, is the first appearance of your aristocratic vampire. All these things are new, relatively new, by the way that people who do my job, for example, measure antiquity. 1819 is just beginning to be a little bit old, whereas to most people it's like, ooh, distant history, whatever. So she didn't do badly with the glittery thing. You know what, the glittery thing is awful,
but
you have to come up with a reason why they can't go out in sunshine, and the idea that they burst into flames is a little bit passé.
Yeah. Babe. The one thing that I always kind of was okay with Twilight was this, both with the wolves and the vampires, is they, I'm going to say realistic, and I don't mean realistic, but I mean, like, it's not, it's sort of plausible in that they could have existed, and you could sort of see where, if they were the real, like, the base model, real vampire that people got the idea from, how they could have come up with these really sort of full-blown legends about, you know, the not going out in sun and all of the kind of things.
What's your other choice? Okay. Why do vampires not go out in sunlight? So if you're sitting there and you're writing a story, how many different options are you going to be capable of coming up with?
Well, either it kills them or it makes them show up in a certain way.
Yeah, and then what would you do in order to explain why it killed them?
Yeah, I don't know.
Sunlight. What's exactly? And you end up in a situation where, because there's this preponderance of law, most of which is completely made up by a whole bunch of people whose job it is to make this stuff up to make it plausible. And just they're going, well, I can't really think of a reason. They're allergic to vitamin D. none of that sounds very good. So you know, tanning salons would be the vampire hell or something. Or you could fight them off with UV lamps or something. Or they could never go into a club. So therefore, your whole Bela Lugosi's dead, 1980s vampires wandering around clubs and all the rest of it. They wouldn't be able to be in there because they'd just catch fire from all the black light. It would just be terrible. You've got to come up with something. She didn't do terribly badly with that. It's a bit silly, but then the whole thing is a bit silly.
Yeah.
The werewolf thing, you're just lucky they were wolves.
Yeah, and not bears or...
Well, bears would be okay. You could get away with that.
But if deer or something.
You look at the totem creatures of various Native American tribes.
Raccoons.
You'd be, yeah, exactly. You're like chipmunks or something. An army of killer chipmunks would be a little bit difficult.
Although a chipmunk the size of a horse would be kind of scary.
Give me pause. This is true. I would worry about that. That would cause me anxiety. But the whole thing is just... In a way, it was perfect. The whole of the Twilight thing was just beautifully done, because it is just so floaty and sort of ephemeral and isn't really nailed down to anything particularly solid.
There was nothing about her mythological concepts that ever bothered me that much. What bothered me was like the terrible writing and everything about Bella Swan and like
everything about all of it.
Nothing about the actual mythological. I wasn't like, oh, this is super stupid. I'm like, this is quite a good idea, quite a good take on these things that would have done really well if you'd just given it to someone else to write. Like, if you know what
questions
I mean.
Questions always crop up from watching this, apart from the fact the whole relationship is really strange and a little bit creepy. I'm a 40-year-old man talking about Teen Wolf today, so, you know.
By my standards, good benchmark, really good odd. Benchmark.
Very strange, yeah, exactly. Why are they all still going to school?
I don't know.
You matriculate a lot. Why would you do that?
We need to stop talking about Twilight. Yeah, I'd be like, I'm just out of school, so I could go have a job or whatever, or be off at college. I don't really want to keep talking, like, theorize about what I would do if I was in Twilight, but, like, but I feel like going through high school over and over again is kind of weird. I feel like they should have posed as just above high school age, so they didn't have to be in school all the time. Like, it's...
Especially if you're Edward and you can read minds.
Yeah.
So you meet teenagers endlessly, and you can read minds. Ugh. Your brain would melt. You just...
He's a weirdo. He's a weirdo. Anyway, enough about Twilight. So we've got, basically, Twilight doesn't really tie into any traditional legends.
They're not werewolves, so it doesn't really...
It may or may not... The wolves may or may not be tied into original Native American legends, or Stephanie Meyer may have made it up. But they are traditional predators to the vampire, which is the same as in Vampire Diaries, right?
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's true, yeah.
So that's our last big fandom that we're talking about today. So, Karen, I have not seen this show, but you two have. So you go ahead.
Yeah, this is really interesting in that I think that this sort of ties into what you were saying, Jonathan, about the traditional folklore a little bit more, in that the idea of a person being a werewolf is actually a family curse, and it's been this way for generations and generations, and it's only activated by killing a human being, and it can be accidental or on purpose. And, you know, as humans, they have supernatural abilities. They're faster and stronger, etc. They have a little bit more of a temper. They're easily angered. On the full moon, they transform into actual wolves. One of the editors for the site, Lexi, she's a huge Teen Wolf fan, and she just started watching The Vampire Diaries, and she's like, I don't understand why they can go right into alpha formation, like, right off the bat. She was a little bit confused about that, but that was just kind of funny. And their transformation is very painful. The bones break and reform. And yeah, their worst enemy is the vampires, and a single werewolf bite can kill a vampire.
So you have seen Vampire Diaries. What Karen was saying about it being more like a
traditional
curse thing, and I mean, I don't know about the vampire versus werewolf thing. I mean, I haven't seen Blade Runner or whatever that is about, like, Blade.
No.
That's a vampire.
In
versus...
fact, probably not even Blade either. So,
what's that thing about vampires and werewolves?
Oh, just that. what's it called? The thing with Kate Beckinsale.
Yeah.
Underworld.
Underworld. But what's that other one about? Is Blade a vampire?
Which is
one?
Pretty much all based on a role-playing game called Vampire: The Masquerade. So it's all about sort of vampires and werewolves living in the same society and keeping each other hidden from each other and all the rest of it.
But Blade is about vampires, yeah.
It is, yep.
I haven't seen any of that, so...
Oh, I like those movies.
I'll watch them.
Pretty good.
But yeah, I mean, so that vampire versus werewolf kind of thing, what do we think about that?
Well, it's new. It's, oddly enough, weird thing is that in the Eastern vampire tradition, not the Western one, remember I was saying about Germanic vampires and the kind of...
When you say Eastern, you mean Eastern European, not
mainly,
Asian.
Yeah, mainly Eastern European, but also edging over into sort of Greece, Turkey, places like that.
Okay.
I think the word is Vrikolakos in Greek, or Vardaluk, or something like that in Serbian, or something peculiar. The word for werewolf and the word for vampire pretty
are
much
the same word.
Same word.
Yeah.
So they mean the same thing. They mean a thing like a revenant, like something that... Vukodlak is the word. The Slavic kind of Eastern werewolf is a thing that is a bit more like a vampire. All of these things get confused in the 19th century. So you've got your cemented vampire, who's a man now in an evening suit, who is sophisticated and posh. For the first time. Before that, he was all feral and unpleasant and lived in a hole in the ground. Now he lives in a castle and is as a lord. And you've got the werewolf, who is either a tragically cursed human who's done something terribly wrong, or is somehow the kind of servant or sister of the vampires. So you end up with this sort of 20th century concept where... I think probably as a result of Hammer House of Horror and the 19 horror movies in America, ends up as being, they all get lumped together. So you've got vampires, werewolves, and Frankenstein's monster. And those are the three staples of all horror films
yeah.
from a certain point. So they all get linked in together, and you've just got to come up with new ways of using them. So werewolves are servants of vampires, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the Vampire Diaries side of things kind of ties into that in that the thing I was talking about earlier on, where vampires live in castles and are aristocratic, and
yeah.
werewolves live in sheds next door to you, and you can't necessarily trust them. In the Vampire Diaries, most of the time, your vampires are personified by people like Ian Somerhalder, with supernatural cheekbones, and a mansion. Stop it.
Sorry.
That kind of stuff.
You sound like his wife.
Yeah, just ridiculous degrees of sort of richness and beauty and perfection. And the werewolves live in trailers. And
is that true? Is that like, I haven't seen the show. Doesn't Vampire Diary also have like witches that are all black and it's a bit dodgy?
There's a bunch of explanations. The main problem is the fact that in that town, everybody's supernatural.
Oh, okay, right.
What's the town called?
Mystic Falls.
Mystic Falls, thank you, yes.
Natalie, how do you know that?
Because we talked about it on the other episode where someone thought that Teen Wolf might have been in the same verse as
How do I know that?
You've watched it. I haven't watched it.
But it is ridiculous.
And I thought you watched it because of... I thought you watched it because of Inez, but you said you watched it because of your brother, which is just even weirder.
That is stranger. That was my little brother Ben, who just went, "You've got to watch Vampire Diaries because Ian Somerhalder is dreamy." And that was the quote. So,
really? Yeah, good family.
It's a good reason. And he is, though. I mean, it's ridiculous. You know, outside of all other considerations, that man is ridiculously perfect looking. You just don't want to look at him. He's just horrible. Anyway, it's a whole thing. But yes, vampires live in mansions and werewolves live in trailers and are usually bikers or something like that. It's a weird thing.
Huh.
You were saying that it's a bit more of a modern thing that werewolves and vampires are enemies, but it actually makes sense from what you were saying before about how the concept of, you know, the vampires live in the castles and the werewolves sort of are the everyman. And I could see where those two types of people, not just the fact that they're, you know, supernatural beings, but those two types of people wouldn't necessarily get along. And I think that sort of translates into this more modern concept of, you know, vampires and werewolves just hate each other because they're basically exact opposites.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they,
so it's like racism.
Kind of.
Or like classism.
Yes, it's
like lower class hating the upper class for being the upper class, and upper class being like, "Oh, you're so beneath me."
Well, if you think about it, vampires are the epitome of control, especially in things like Twilight, modern references.
Yeah,
they are totally in control of everything they do. They are perfect, rich, they're influential, and the rest of it. Whereas werewolves are totally out of control, so they're like us getting drunk on a Friday night and throwing stuff, whereas vampires are people who are just like, "Yeah, that's absolutely right. I've got a job at Barings Bank, and I'm incredibly wealthy, and I own two Jaguars, and this kind of stuff. So that it is very much a class polarity, because you need both of those things when you're writing or creating something, I suppose, supernatural or this sort of brand of fiction. You have to have the polarity because it's all very black and white and all very clear.
And Vampire Diaries is the only one that we've touched on that seems to have that aspect of like
True Blood, does it?
It being a curse. Well, yeah, I didn't put True Blood on because I haven't seen it, and it's weird that you have.
I haven't seen it either.
It's exactly the same dynamic. Vampires live in giant mansions with Spanish moss and servants, and werewolves are bikers who live in a hole in the ground. And that's basically how it's kind of covered. And it is that polarity, that disconnect between nature, red in tooth and claw and running around through the woods, not really quite in control of itself, and civilization personified by someone like Ian Somerhalder.
The whole thing with Vampire Diaries about it also killing, like, you know, activated by killing a human, that sounds more like the traditional, like, oh, you were a cannibal, now you're cursed forever kind of thing.
Yeah.
So those are the main ones we're talking about. So how do you think, like, in general, like, which one out of all of the ones that we've spoken about do you think is the most real, quote unquote, for, or like how do they compare? Which one do you think holds up to tradition the best, or which one do you like the way that they've tied into tradition the best?
Well, I'll go with two choices. The one that ties mostly into tradition, and there isn't a lot of tradition, this is the thing that you've got to remember about this, is probably the J.K. Rowling view of it.
Yeah.
That's your standard understandable. The werewolf I would have known about when I was 12 or
13. Yeah, the folklore, the kind of horror movie guy.
The most interesting and the one that toys with history the most is definitely Teen Wolf. The one that looks for alternatives and options and comes up with what may possibly blossom into an interesting pantheon is Teen Wolf.
Yeah.
Twilight doesn't count because they're not vampires. They're not werewolves. They're not really... They don't really sort of fit into the entire thing. Although they're a nice kind of... They're a well-done variation, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
Buffy and Angel, they're incidental. They're kind of like out there, but we don't really talk about them. Supernatural, again, they're out there, but we don't talk about them very often. We met one once in Kansas in the 80s or something. It's kind of like that. And they're all very straightforward. It looks a bit like a man-wolf thing, and it eats people's hearts, and we shoot it with a silver bullet, and it dies. So there's a limited amount of narrative leeway you've got with that under those circumstances. I suppose Vampire Diaries has to come a kind of creditable third because they have a setup, they have a system, they have a kind of hierarchy, and they're paying attention to it. And it's, you know, it sort of works. It works quite well. But everything in that program is so shiny that it's...
In Vampire Diaries.
Yeah, it's all just so glossy and shiny and everyone's so pretty that I don't know, you have difficulty getting your head around it. It's like a sort of supernatural gossip girl or something. It's really strange. A lot of people really love it. I enjoy seeing it.
Karen, what mythology, what werewolf mythology did you like the best?
I would actually have to completely agree with all of that because I think the Harry Potter universe does the best job of sort of placing this traditional folkloric idea of werewolves into modern society. And as far as, you know, what little we do know about the werewolves, I think J.K. Rowling does a really great job of portraying that, I guess. And so, yeah, I would say hers is probably the best, although, you know, and obviously I am kind of partial to it, but I think Teen Wolf does a great job, especially knowing now what we know about the traditional stories and how much they actually have pulled from it. I think it's really interesting to see how well they've done their research for the show.
Yeah. I mean, Jonathan, is there any kind of werewolf book or movie or whatever that you'd... Well, we've got a couple of honourable mentions of other werewolf shows that we, you know, don't really have time to go into with each one or not everyone's seen, but, like, I'm introducing Karen to Being Human, the UK version at the moment, which is one of my favourite shows about both vampires and werewolves, and I love the mythology in this show. It's a great show. I haven't seen the US version, so I'm not going to, like, outright hate on it. I don't like US adaptations. I don't understand why you can't just show the UK one in America, but But the UK version is amazing, and I love it. And then, obviously, yes. you've touched on Supernatural as well.
I was just going to say, you know, as far as Being Human goes, yeah, I've watched the first series, and it is so good, and I'm so glad that Natalie told me to watch it. I've been meaning to watch it for a while. It's an
amazing werewolf and vampire show. Amazing.
You're like some sort of...
I really wanted to say...
What did you say?
Some sort of enabler for weird vampire and werewolf programs or something.
Well, you know,
not just that.
You told me to do it.
Yeah. Well, that's the reason why I have to go really soon is because I have to go see Star Trek Into Darkness, which Natalie made me watch the first one.
Oh no! So, really? Yeah. Oh god! What time is your showing?
1 o'clock.
Okay,
so
we've got to hurry. Yeah,
I just wanted to say really quickly that in Being Human, the transformation of the werewolf is absolutely amazing. It's the best transformation I've seen because I don't know how they do it, but they morph his face. Maybe they just do it so slowly and that it pulls the skin and it's just so disgusting. But it looks so realistic to me.
It's very
crazy.
It's great considering it was a BBC Three show. It's a BBC Three show. It didn't have a big budget. It's amazing. And it's if any of you watch Doctor Who or if any of you have watched The Hobbit, if it's the main characters are Aidan Turner, who played Killy in The Hobbit, who I've been loved for years and years, and now I found it really weird that he was in The Hobbit, and Russell Tovey, who's been in, like, Sherlock and Doctor Who, and he's one of the history boys, and he's a famous British actor, and he's the werewolf, and Aidan Turner's the vampire, and then there's a ghost girl as well, Annie, who's awesome, and it sounds, again, it sounds like a joke, like, it sounds like, oh, a werewolf, a vampire, and a... ghost walk into a bar kind of thing. They live together.
Yeah.
And it sounds like, oh, Teen Wolf. Like, it sounds like a joke. It's amazing. So that's a great werewolf show that I like. Anything, yeah, as I was saying, anything that you would recommend, Jonathan, even like a traditional book that werewolf fans should read or a film?
Well, there's tons of books. There's always tons of books. Actually, one thing I saw recently, which we haven't mentioned, but is pretty new and fairly hardcore, is Hemlock Grove, which has a lot of strange, previously not very well covered werewolf lore involved in it, including my favourite method of turning someone into a werewolf, which is if they drink water from the footprint of a wolf. And that occurs in
wow.
And that's
that's likely. That's something that you'd come across pretty often.
Yeah, but that's one of the oldest methods. It's like I was saying earlier on that wolfsbane is a traditional cure.
Okay. So that one is that mythology is
turning into one is to drink water from the footprint of whatever beast you want to turn into, and that's that the first time I've ever seen that in a fictional kind of context.
Okay, so that's something that comes from the old lore, is that right?
Yeah, that's whale.
Is there any pieces? I was going to say, is there any pieces of old lore that you think would come up in or should come up in Teen Wolf? Not drinking the water from a footstep of a werewolf, but you know.
Probably not, but I mean, there's a whole load of tradition. I mean, the main thing in fictional werewolf, I suppose pre-movies or tales or whatever you want to call it, is that the werewolves are the personification of the deep woods, of the thing you shouldn't go near, of the way that you should, you know, behave. And they're one of the strangely... You know how Teen Wolf has that thing where sexuality and gender preference and all the rest of it have no... Everything is just, like, kind of just there. It's not really commented on or critique or anything like that. It's just a thing. And werewolves are kind of like the same sort of concept. They are focused towards the whole female idea. So girls enter puberty and then they have to have these kind of, like, massive lessons read to them by older women or by their... custodians or whatever, that they can't stray from the path and that they mustn't talk to that guy with the hairy eyebrows and this kind of stuff. And that's... Werewolves have always been deeply involved in the whole sort of, like, developing effect of mythology and folklore. Maybe it's not a great idea to have that appearing all over pop culture, but it is a definite aspect and something that probably best done in Company of Wolves in the 80s by Angela Carter, who wrote a series of revamped...
I feel like that could come up with the Alpha Pack.
Yeah.
Don't you, Karen?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that kind of threatening, like, yeah, aspect.
Because it is the threat of wildness. That's what it's about. It's the threat of things being feral and uncontrollable. And it's the continuation of where the whole werewolf thing stemmed from. I mean, Sabine Baring-Gould, who is the guy that 60s who wrote the Book of Werewolves, which is where most of this information that we use these days comes from, he put forward the concept that werewolf legends are mainly there to account for and explain things like serial killers and, well, I already mentioned cannibalism, things like that, but there was a man called Peter Stump in the 16th century who was tried and executed as a werewolf. He was called the Werewolf of Bedburg, I think, and he was a serial killer. Basically, he just killed lots of people and ate them, and was caught. And instead of being executed as we would now execute him, well, we wouldn't execute him, but we'd now try him as a serial killer and lock him up. In those days, he was tried and executed as a werewolf, which means that the two concepts that are kind of almost interchangeable, or were at that particular point. I think there's something very deeply sinister. And I think we often, nowadays, in various strands of pop culture, we take away from the sinister. We make everything very cuddly, in a way. So there's the vampires in Vampire Diaries are just gorgeous and rich and kind of occasionally amusing, and not actually killing machines. And the werewolves in various other sort of pop culture incarnations are sort of, you know, quite cuddly, really, and if they were, you know, lying in front of your fire or something like that. And I think it needs to get a bit, occasionally it needs to get a bit more hardcore and then come back again. So it's all, you know, there's a lot to be done with that kind of thing.
But yeah, I agree with
that. Teen Wolf gives me a lot of, I enjoy it because it's doing things without talking about them. The whole idea of, you know, the way it treats teen politics and this kind of stuff, you know, the kind of clique idea and the whole high school dynamic, and then the way it treats the supernatural. It's doing it without asking you if it can. It's just saying, this is what I'm going to do. This is how we're going to write this story. I don't really care. The Mountain Ash thing, for example, is a complete theft of concepts from sort of various British or Northern European fairy and, you know, fae kind of legends, and druidism and this kind of stuff. There's all that kind of the old English mythology chucked into it, where you pin people to the ground with mistletoe if they're evil and this kind of stuff. The mountain ash, various types of wood, various types of plants, this kind of stuff. That all comes from an ancient, kind of very Northern European mythology, rather than anything that would have any application to America, I suppose. But, you know, they're just taking and using and twisting in a way that they see is going to be a good thing, and they're doing it without being particularly self-conscious about it, which I'm kind of looking forward to seeing more of it, and I think it's going to be an interesting thing.
Cool. Yeah, I think they leave the door open for a lot of different directions that they can go in with the show. And I think that's really great, because I'd love to see the world sort of expand and turn into something that isn't necessarily super traditional as far as what we know in, you know, modern culture as werewolves, but maybe go more down those really traditional paths.
Yeah. Cause the enemy of anything is its rule set. Right. So you have werewolves, you have anything that we deal with on a daily basis. Problem with it is usually that it has defined borders and that it has definitions and it has like kind of genres and categories. If you can break any of those and move them in any direction, which is probably the best thing you can say about Twilight, is that it took certain genre tropes and it twisted them in a certain way and made you probably hate it, but look at it from a different way. So Teen Wolf is kind of doing that in a way that lots of other stuff doesn't. I mean, you can usually guarantee that people like Joss Whedon are going to do that in some way, shape or form. But in sort of the mainstream, it's a good thing to be looking out for. It's a thing to be seeing in, you know, more of, I think, if you possibly can.
Yeah.
If you guys are looking for other shows that have werewolves in them, you know, obviously we mentioned Being Human and Supernatural. Once Upon a Time has werewolves in it too. That's sort of a twist, so I'm not actually going to tell you what it's about in case you haven't been spoiled for that show at all. And Grimm is another good one that has werewolves in it, and that's a very traditional sort of Grimm's fairy tale, Germanic folklore type of show, and they're called Blutbads, and it's a very, very different way of exploring werewolves than what we see in a lot of the modern adaptations of those stories. So those are all good shows. I watch all of them, and I think that they're really interesting to see.
And then the one you mentioned, Jonathan, was Hemlock Grove, is that right?
Yeah, it's very recent.
Yeah, I think it's only just started, right, or something like that.
And it's very much more Slavonic, not the Germanic werewolf idea, but the more sort of Eastern idea.
Okay.
And also it includes kind of a sort of Russian vampire concept, which is quite interesting, and is very, very sinister. It's deeply unpleasant in various areas, but interesting. It also reintroduces what was once one of the most important aspects of all vampire and werewolf mythology, which is gypsies.
Ah, like Romany kind of thing.
Or whatever, yeah. It brings that back. Because originally, of course, that's how all these stories were circulated across Europe.
With the travellers.
Yeah, itinerant peoples moving them, going from place to place. And that's probably why there's so much congruence between... the Indian concepts of were creatures and this kind of stuff, and the European concepts, because I think originally, theoretically anyway, the Romani itinerant peoples were migrants from India who managed to make their way across the entirety of everything between India and Europe, and then ended up being migratory and travelling around mainly Eastern Europe and then moving us to sort of the northern areas later on, and they carry with them their myths and they carry with them their stories and their superstitions, and that's how they get distributed across the whole sort of, you know, the whole breadth of the old world, as it were, in the same way that the Lugaroo of French Canada borrows an awful lot from the Native American Wendigo and things like that. There's a lot.
They mentioned the Lugaroo in Teen Wolf, like, is that just the name for werewolf in that?
It just means basically werewolf in the kind of the French pantheon, as it were, but it's sort of French Canadian. And again, all of these myths can be localized in places that have big dark woods. it kind of comes unknown. So for the Native Americans, it was the Wendigo. For the French settlers, it was, you know, the voyageurs, etc. It was the Lugaroo. The 1865 Book of Werewolves talks about the Lugaroo quite in fairly good detail. So I should probably produce a reading list or something.
Well, perhaps you could send me one, and we could put it on. But I was going to say, do you have a favourite werewolf novel or movie as well? Like,
well, one of my favourites is actually there's a book by a man called Tim Powers called The Anubis Gates, which is not strictly speaking a werewolf novel, but in it, one of the characters gradually turns into Anubis, the Egyptian god of the.
All right.
Werejackal, and it's. It's what I was saying earlier on about, you know, the apex predator. Whatever civilization you come from, the local apex predator is the thing that people will turn into when you can't trust them.
Yeah,
right.
Like a tiger or something.
If you look at ancient Egypt, the basic thing to remember about the Egyptian, the ancient Egyptian mythology is that everything impressive is a were creature of some kind. And you find this across the board. So in India, they have were tigers. In South America, they have were jaguars and this kind of stuff. So it obviously fulfills some sort of deep need that we have. I think it ties into that whole idea of, you know, looking out into the darkness, into the forest or whatever, and thinking that there must be something out there, and then turning around and looking at all the other people that you hang out with and thinking that there's probably a lot of secrets there as well. And when the two things collide, you have a natural assumption that there's some sort of collision between civilization and the feral, the forest, the darkness, the nature, etc. It's a deep-seated thing with human beings. Probably as old and as traditional as being afraid of the dark. So werewolves tie into that very deeply. I was just going to say, probably in a way that vampires don't, because vampires are very much a sort of, they're kind of a glossy, shiny version. They're kind of like the Harvard MBA version in terms of sort of, you know, boogeyman type of thing. It's something that you have to be scared of because it's smarter than you, it's faster than you, it's got a strange agenda that you have no connection with, whereas a werewolf is a lot more simpler and straightforward. It's a thing that wants to eat you, but it's smart and it could be the person standing next to you. So there's a complicated psychology behind all of these particular sort of folklore creatures. There's always a good reason, if you see what I mean, why these things exist. in folklore.
And in that case, why do you think that they're so easy to sympathise with in pop culture now? Because it seems like with Lupin, with Teen Wolf, with, I assume, with these people on Vampire Diaries, and with Oz, like, these are very sympathetic characters. So where do you think that comes from?
We sympathise very strongly with people who are excluded, probably because we see ourselves being excluded. You're either thinking that you're being excluded, or you genuinely are being, or it's a combination of both, and you're experiencing being excluded. But it's to do with the being made other, being pushed outside, being pushed beyond the boundary of the light. That's why they're sympathetic, because if you know who they really are, and you know, you will have to reject them, or most people will have to reject them. So if everyone finds out that so-and-so is a werewolf, or so-and-so is a vampire, or whatever, they'll be cast out from their existing system, their existing surroundings. So we sympathise with them because they're almost outcasts. Underdogs.
Fair enough.
I think. That's one aspect of it, anyway.
Okay, well, we will have to probably finish up now, as Karen had to go to her movie quite a while ago. But we will potentially make you come on and talk to us again at some point.
I'd love to.
In the meantime,
I'll try and do better next time, I promise.
In the meantime, if people who are listening want to give you any feedback, do you want to tell them where to reach you, a.k.a. on your Twitter or your blog or whatever?
Yeah, the Twitter's fine, or the blog. You can find me under Bibliodeviant nearly anywhere.
On Twitter, I will put his thing in the Twitter in the notes. But,
I'll certainly look forward to receiving feedback.
Yeah.
with my fingers crossed, anyway.
Oh, well, I don't know. We get some feedback sometimes. But, you know, let us know what you think, anyway, of this episode. So, we will see you all soon, I guess.
Well, thank you very much for asking me to come along.
I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope that you've enjoyed putting up with Teen Wolf so far.
Yes, definitely.
All right, so that's the end of our bite-sized about our different werewolf mythologies. So I'll just say bye to Karen. So bye.
Bye.
And we will speak to you next week or the week after, either in advance of the premiere or straight after the premiere of Teen Wolf Season 3. So bye!
Bye!
Bye! Hang on. Whatever just happened.
View of it is that you're cursed. And
hang on. Again. Are you moving anything around, like physically?
I was waving my arms about. Should I keep?
Try not to. And just say the tradition. Start from like the traditional and try. Yeah, I think it's just slightly making it cut to the point where I'm like keeping like, are you cutting out? And then you're not. And I just try and not wave your arms around.
Okay.
Or do it very quietly.
I'll keep very still with my arms.
But just be like, whatever you're saying.